So we are in Boston at the Sheraton. Meeting is called One Mind for Research, Next Frontier of the Brain Forum, imagining the next decade of neuroscience research and development. And yesterday there was a symposium on the neurobiological consequences of war, which was introduced by Max Cleland, Senator Max Cleland. But then the first speaker, the Silver Professor of Psychology and Neuroscience at NYU, New York University, Elizabeth Phelps, talked about the neurobiology of post-traumatic stress disorder. The emotional brain is really your territory. You've made this very much your own area. Could you just revisit for us a little bit of what you were saying yesterday?
Sure.
We actually have the footage, of course.
So what I talked about yesterday was that normally fear processing requires a network of regions. The amygdala, which is involved in the sort of acquisition of fear memories as they're expressed through your body's response. But the amygdala is kept in check by two very important regions, the prefrontal cortex, which is quite large in humans, and the hippocampus, which sort of tells you where it's appropriate to have a fear response. And so normally what happens in humans is, you know, the amygdala learns that something's fearful, but now maybe you have new information that situation is no longer fearful, so then the prefrontal cortex can inhibit that fear memory, or, you know, it's appropriate to be afraid of something when you're in a dangerous situation, but not appropriate to be afraid of the same thing, such as a tiger when you're in a zoo. And the hippocampus kind of lets you know now's the right time to have that fear response or not. And these brain circuits have to work together to have adaptive fear responding. What happens in PTSD is that they get out of sync. So stress hormones, you know, enhance the amygdala function, but actually impairs the function of the prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus. So now we have sort of an amygdala that's sort of overactive, and the regions that control the amygdala are somewhat underactive. And this is really, I just want to point out, a very simple model of how we understand PTSD. Mm-hmm. It's really much more complex than this, but I think this is the basis for starting to investigate fear-related disorders and, you know, how we can facilitate the processes that might bring those systems back in balance.
So one thinks of movies like The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind and so on, and there's, you've written papers about extinction of fear, memories, and so on. How is that possible?
I mean, so probably what you're referring to is not extinction per se. Extinction is really, now I've learned that this thing is safe, but I still have the fear memory, but, you know, that's still there. But now I know this thing is safe. One of the things we're trying to do now is actually create situations where we alter the memory, the fear memory itself. So extinction just inhibits the fear memory to express, you know, to express my new notion that this is safe. Mm-hmm. But if we can actually change the representation of the fear as it's represented in the amygdala, then the fear might never come back. So what happens when you do regular extinction training? So now, you know, you were afraid of something, I teach you, I expose you to that thing, it's never, you know, there's no bad consequences, you know, I know it's safe. What happens then is that, you know, both memories are there, they compete for expression. So sometimes the fear comes back. You get stressed, the fear comes back. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you can actually change the fear memory itself, then you prevent the fear from ever coming back. So that's an exciting area of research called reconsolidation. It, you know, technically has something to do with, you know, in theory, erasing memories. It's really much more complex than that, but it brings to mind things like The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. One of the things to point out, though, is what we're trying to target is the bodily's expression of fear, which is independent in the brain from your knowledge of the events that occurred. So in The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, he has no memory whatsoever of, say, Kate Winslet earlier on when, you know, before he erased his memories. That would not happen with the techniques we're looking at. What we're trying to do is alter the fear response, but because the fear response memory is separate from our knowledge of the events, we're targeting one but not the other. So you still know the bad thing occurred, right? You still have very good memory for the situation, but you just don't have the same fear response. That's the hope with this type of research. And research looking at sort of what we call the reconsolidation, this is restorage process of the memory that we're targeting, of memories for the knowledge of the events, suggest we can't target memories in the same way. We can't actually create that situation like you would see in the internal sunshine of the spotless mind, because those memories are stored all over the brain, as opposed to localized just in the amygdala. So it's actually somewhat advantageous. We can perhaps remove some of the fear response that comes with the event, but we don't get rid of your memory for the event, which you would call your memory for the event. Now, I just, again, want to point out the way I'm talking about it right now is really still science fiction. But, you know, there is a little bit of science that points that we might to the direction of being able to do that in real life situations. Right now, we're doing it in the laboratory with things like tones and shocks or blue squares and shocks. It's very, very simple. May or may not extend to really complex situations. We'll see.
So one of the other panelists yesterday, for example, I remember Colonel Jeffrey Ling was giving all these heartbreaking stories of people who had been seriously traumatized in Afghanistan, Iraq, or whatever.
Yep.
I mean, is the sort of thing that you're talking about practicably applicable?
See, at this point, I have no idea, right? We're doing this research because we think it might be, right? But I think it's really important to make the point that this really is science fiction at this point in time. You know, so this whole conference here is about the next frontiers in brain science. You know, brain science is suggesting a lot of interesting ways to look at how we process fear, how we process memories, that would provide novel treatments. Some subset of them will end up being really effective. Whether understanding reconsolidation is one of them, I don't think we know at this point.
Yeah. The whole concept of memory is still a little spooky for most people when you actually start thinking about it and looking at the research. I mean, you know, one can read Proust and think about the Madeleine and bringing back the memories and so on and so forth, but one also knows that memories are a kind of distributed, adaptive, representational networks. And when you revisit them, you alter them.
Yes.
So there's this strange paradox, is there not, of wondering whether what you think you are, who you are, and where you've been is actually accurate.
Yes, absolutely. It's an interesting, you know, I think our sort of popular notion of view of memory is kind of like a tape recorder, where it should, you know, it's always exactly how it was.
Right.
And if you do memory research, you know that's absolutely not correct. Memory is fluid, it's dynamic. And there is an interesting balance between knowing that our memories are not always what we think they are, but yet they are also reliable in situations, you know, when we need them, right? So, so you try to think about, when you think about memory mistakes, and we can generate memory mistakes in the laboratory, I can, you know, ask you questions and probably get you to say something that I know isn't accurate about your memory and you think it is. You know, we're good at that with memory research. But the mistakes we make usually have a purpose and a function. You know, and I think actually Dan Schachter has written a lovely book called The Seven Sins of Memory that kind of points out, like, when we make memory mistakes, it's because actually the generalizations, you know, are relevant to the reason why we're remembering something, for instance, right? So they actually have a purpose and a function in helping us move forward with our lives, even though, you know, we may think that having a veridical account of what happened and what didn't happen is the best way for us to use our memories for future actions, to help inform future actions. But the truth is, you know, for memory to be really useful, it probably is going to be more flexible than that.
Yeah. I'm just curious about, on the flight out here, I picked up Usual Time and Newsweek, and the cover of Time was Sex, Lies, Arrogance, What Makes Powerful Men Act Like Pigs, which I suppose was a...
Yes, well, everybody's asking that question right now.
And on Newsweek, there was The Good Wife. So which put me thinking about male-female differences.
Yes.
Are there any gender differences that have turned up in your work in memory?
So there are some sex differences in fear learning, but I don't think they're very well understood at this point. You know, we, in general, we always look for sex differences. Only rarely do we see them. So, you know, we did a pharmacological manipulation to try to alter reconsolidation. It didn't quite work, but there was some evidence that it was suggestive work. So there were some suggestions that it was doing something, and that was only for females, for instance. The sex hormones, you know, that vary between males and females have receptors in the brain regions we talked about, like the amygdala. Mm-hmm. And you see higher incidence of things like anxiety disorders and depression in females than males, and that may be related to that. So there are gender differences in memory and emotion, but we don't quite, you know, understand them in detail. And what is very clear is that there are much more similarities between the genders than there are differences. You know, so, you know, we talk about, you know, the sort of brains being very different between males and females. The truth is they're overwhelmingly the same, with some slight differences.
Yeah.
And I think when it comes to things like emotion and memory, we see differences occasionally, sex differences occasionally, but not very often. And we don't really have a good way of characterizing when and how and where.
Yeah.
We're going to see a sex difference at this point.
So I've also happened to have with me a recent issue of The Scientist. The cover mm-hmm. is studying the emotional brain, social signals, mental illness.
I have to read that.
And the amygdala.
Yes.
Face-to-face with the emotional brain.
Yep.
Emotions, yes, but reason mm-hmm. also.
Yep. So I think, you know, the term emotional brain has become very popular.
Yeah.
And sort of this contrast between emotion and reason has become quite popular. But
right.
if there's one thing brain science has taught us, is that the brain systems that we think, you know, are related to emotion and those that we think are related to cognition are intertwined at every level of analysis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at every, you know, from early perception, you know, to higher cognition. So in theory, it's next to impossible to, you know, separate the two. And, you know, we use the notion of emotion and reason or you know, rationality, you know, versus irrationality. These go back to early philosophical thought. And so
right.
I think it's quite easy for us to fall into this notion that, you know, I'm using one part of my brain or another part of my brain, or I'm either, you know, emotions driving my choice or, you know, or my reasons driving my choice. And the truth is, you know, you can't separate it that way. You know, emotion tells you what matters.
Mm-hmm.
If that's not part of your reasoning, that's a problem. You know, and so I think it's just, you know, we can highlight some brain regions like the amygdala that seem to play, you know, a bigger role in things like, you know, threats, detecting threats or detecting what matters to you. But, you know, one of the hallmarks of the amygdala is its massive interconnections with the rest of the brain. So if you look at a connectivity map of the brain, the amygdala looks like Grand Central Station in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And what that tells you is, you know, the amygdala doesn't generate your emotional response. It tells you this is relevant. And when something's relevant, it's changing your perceptions. It's changing your decisions. It's changing your memories. It should.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's relevant to you, you know, is what you should be acting on,
mm-hmm.
right? So, you know, I understand this notion of the emotional brain, but really it's not the emotional brain. It's not the rational brain. It's one brain, and you can't cleanly separate the two.
And the fact that you're talking about it acting as a relay station for telling you what's relevant,
mm-hmm.
obviously, different individuals,
sure.
different backgrounds,
absolutely.
Some people are going to have what other people would perceive as a corrupted view of what's relevant.
Yeah,
and that's.
And I think, you know, I think that's one of the things that's underappreciated about emotion. So we often think of emotion as, you know, this sort of natural reaction you have to the situation.
Yeah.
A huge part of emotion is what you bring to the table. How do you interpret that situation? You know, are you a person that generally sees this as a threat? Are you a person that generally sees this as, you know, something that doesn't matter? Are you a person that sees this as a welcome opportunity, right? And so we call that appraisal in emotion, but appraisal is a big component of our emotional life. And one of the things they'll teach you in therapy, in cognitive therapy, is, you know, why do you assume this person, you know, doesn't like you when you first meet them, for instance, right?
Right?
What evidence do you have? Change the way you think and you change your emotions. And so, again, you know, we talk about sort of emotion influencing our cognitions, but a big part of our cognitions influences our emotion.
Would you just unpack this word reconsolidation
yes,
a little bit for me?
Yes, absolutely. So the standard view of memory, sort of the classical view of memory, is you learn something, you encounter something, and you're going to form a memory of that event. There's a period of time where that memory for that event gets set in your brain. So even though the storage process is, you know, is non-conscious to you, your brain's working overtime to lay down the neuronal changes that make that memory. And that takes time. And that time window, that process we call consolidation. And what we know is until the memory trace is laid down in your brain, in your neurons, your memory is fragile. So if someone, for instance, got a concussion,
right.
You know, they might not remember what happened, right? Because that process of memory storage consolidation was disrupted. So we've known about that for a long time, and there's very good evidence for consolidation occurring. And in rats, you can inject drugs that interrupt, you know, the protein synthesis that's needed to lay down the memory traces, et cetera. So it's generally been thought that once, however, a memory is consolidated, it's there in your brain. And now you retrieve the memory, you pull out that trace, you retrieve it a second time, you pull out the same trace. What's happened over the last decade or so is there's been a renewed interest in this idea that every time you retrieve a memory now, it goes through a second consolidation process. We call that reconsolidation process.
Right.
And now, and because of that, there's a time window, again, a second time window, where the memory is fragile, where it can be disrupted. Now, and so let's say you learned something a year ago. Now when you retrieve that memory, instead of just going right back into its place, now needs to be restored again. And that takes some protein synthesis. So now if I can inject a protein synthesis inhibitor, you know, I can disrupt the storage of that memory. The reconsolidation process we're learning from the neurobiologist is not identical to the consolidation process, but there does seem to be evidence that you need new memory formation to restore memory every time you retrieve it. And that's reconsolidation.
Okay. Now, when I was talking to Carl Dicerath yesterday, for example, we were talking about this whole notion of optogenetics and anxiety pathways.
Yeah.
And he actually has on his HHMI page a quote where he talks about being interested in talking to philosophers and so on about the ethical issues of all of these sorts of things as well. I know you had a conversation on Edge with Brockman and a few other people, Sam Harris and a few other folks.
Sure.
There are ethical implications in all of these things. What's your current feeling about this?
You know, these are not memory processes that develop so that we can inject drugs into your brain and disrupt your memories, right?
Mm.
These are memory processes that developed for a reason, and they're ongoing, constantly, right? All we're doing is understanding them.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, when it creates a new ethical issue because we can understand memory, which tells me that now I can manipulate it more specifically, for instance, perhaps in the treatment of an anxiety disorder.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that to me is no different than, you know, understanding the pain pathway so that I can deliver anesthesia when there's a problem with pain.
Right.
Right. Now, does it open up the possibility for, you know, somebody with bad intentions now trying to purposely manipulate memory? Absolutely. I would argue that happens in the courtroom all the time. You know, maybe they're not doing it with a huge, you know, insight into what the brain science is, right? But, you know, we're all trying to convince people that, you know, things happened or didn't happen, and you know, we know that memory's not accurate. You know, and we're all trying to find ways to you know, in everyday life, we're actually, you know, involved in, you know, altering memory and questioning memory. So I think these pathways are there anyways. There are ethical issues anytime you manipulate any human behavior, but we do it in education, right? And now we're talking about doing it in therapy. I don't think that's a bad thing.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because this currently April issue of Scientific American was a piece in here by Mike Gazzaniga, of course, on neuroscience in the courts.
Yes.
So these boundaries
and
the implications of and understanding neuroscience, Pat Churchland's latest book, Brain Trust, what neuroscience has to say about morality and so on. Understanding the brain, which is obviously the main focus of this entire meeting, is plainly hugely important and is beginning to have a burgeoning influence on how we conduct ourselves in these various other disciplines.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, Mike was the head of the MacArthur Law and Neuroscience Network, which I was part of.
Right.
And, you know, my biggest concern, I think we do have a public responsibility to make sure that, you know, the things that we do are being used reasonably. So one thing that's happening with brain science in the courts right now is, you know, you'll often see in a sentencing hearing someone putting up a brain scan, saying, you know, is this you know, this person couldn't be responsible because here's their brain.
Right.
And right now we don't have the science to back that up. You know, there's also individuals who are selling technology to say, I can look at your brain and tell if you're lying. We don't have the technology to back that up. When we do have the technology to back that up, you know, then I think the scientists should talk about that, right? But when we don't have the technology to back that up, and it's and people are trying to enter that in a court, I think the scientists should speak up as well.
Yeah.
So it's one thing. So I don't mean to say there's no ethical issues involved in understanding memory, but my concern as a scientist is more when someone tries to take the science and be misleading or use it to, you know, to convince people of things that may not, you know, who don't have all the information that may not actually be true. And so then I think that's when it really bothers me and I feel like I really have to speak up.
All right, the intersection of science and society then.
Yeah.
One of my standard questions mm-hmm. about President Obama saying that his administration will restore science to its rightful place. What is the rightful place?
I don't know. What was Obama referring to in that case?
Well, he was talking about, I think he was talking about the what might have been perceived by other people as the lack of attention to accurate science during the previous administration.
Okay.
So he's talking about restoring to its rightful place, but he didn't actually give any coordinates.
Yes.
I've been asking a lot of scientists what they thought
the
appropriate relationship is.
One of the things we know about, you know, is our minds can play tricks on us, right? A lot of people do reasoning by anecdotes. You know, like I had an uncle who smoked for 20 years and he never had any problems, so it doesn't really matter, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of political stories are this way too, right? You know, here's the person that abused the welfare, so we don't need welfare, right? And I think, you know, as scientists, we are good at getting evidence. To not let sort of our reasoning and our anecdotes and our, you know, favorite hypotheses that, you know, we're motivated about influence the choices and decisions we make.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the proper place of science is to provide, you know, evidence based on data out there that, you know, either supports or does not support assumptions of the government, whether that's ways to treat combat veterans, as we talked about here,
mm-hmm.
you know, or to make decisions about funding or to make social decisions about things like welfare, there's evidence, you know, that we can gather that can help inform those decisions. And scientists, that's what we do. We look at the world, we gather evidence, and we try the very best we can to do this in an unbiased manner. Of course, scientists have their own biases, but, you know, that's really our goal.
Yeah, I think it was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and we often mm-hmm. quote at the Science Network, who said that everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts.
Exactly.
So,
yeah. Good point.
Yeah. So you're well known. This whole notion of the emotional brain mm-hmm. is much associated with you, and also with Joe Ledoux, of course.
Because he wrote a book called The Emotional Brain.
He did indeed. and has a band called the Amygdaloids, of course, as you well know.
Yes, I do. Half of the
band. You don't play music, do you?
No, but Joe keeps raiding my lab to bring them into the Amygdaloids, like Daniela and now
sure.
Jonathan and Nina. They were all in my, you know, half the band is my lab, so I take some credit. I have no musical talent myself, though.
So. How did you get into science in the first place? Book, teacher, parents? What was the...
Well, my parents were scientists. But I actually, you know, when people ask me how I got into science, I don't even remember thinking about it. I didn't actually think I'd be a scientist. I always thought I'd get a PhD because everybody in my family has a PhD, right? This is the stupid way kids reason.
Yeah.
But I feel like I got very lucky. You know, when I was an undergraduate, I was torn between psychology and philosophy. I would take these philosophy classes and we would discuss things for a long time, and I was interested in how people worked, and philosophy talks about that all the time.
Where was this?
Ohio Wesleyan, small little school in Ohio. But at the end of the philosophy, you know, whole semester talking about these issues in philosophy, you know, I'd want the answer. And there was no answer,
yeah.
You know, and that really came from psychology, you know, in terms of thinking about how people work. And so I then pretty heavily got into psychology, and I had a wonderful mentor named Harry Barrick, which at a small school like that, you know, you actually get to do research and things like that with, you know, a faculty member. And that, you know, and then I went straight to graduate school. And I think when I think about a lot of my friends who, you know, try to figure out what they like or don't like, I feel like I just fell into it, you know, and I've liked it and I've been very lucky.
So from where you are now and having a lab, directing a lab with students and so on, there's a little book that Sir Peter Medawar once wrote called Advice to a Young Scientist.
Yes, I've heard of it. I actually haven't read it.
It's fun. Yeah. Nice little book. What advice do you give to young scientists?
Wow, it's a really good question. I worry about this a lot these days. Yeah. You know, a lot of my career benefited from being in the right place at the right time. And I don't mean to downplay, you know, my own insight in putting myself there or the hard work that I put in. But brain science is expanding rapidly. You know, when I started studying the human brain, there were not a lot of people. When I started studying the amygdala in humans, there were no published. There was only one published study, I should say, at the time on the amygdala in humans. And now, you know, you could have several books, wow. Right? And I'm not that old.
No, right? No.
So I'm just saying, you know, within the last 20 years, you know, this field has been created.
Right.
You know, and it's a different world than it is when I got into it. So my best advice is, you know, this is what you love. This is what you need to do. When I have a student who comes to me and they're kind of toying with the idea that, you know, maybe I could do something else. Maybe I'd like that better. I almost always advise them to go try that. Because, you know, the likelihood of success in this field is, you know, when you are successful, it's great, but getting there is not easy. And unless you're completely committed to it and confident in your abilities, it's going to be quite tough. And so, you know, but I have students, and this is the one thing they love. You know, this is the what they would think about all the time. This is what they want to do. And those are the ones that I say, you know, just, you know, if you love it, you have to do it. You know, just know that, you know, sometimes you're going to be thrown curveballs, and you have to have confidence in yourself.
Right. So where do you see this field going in the next? I mean,
it's a very good question, and I think about it a lot actually, mostly in the context of advising my students. And I could not predict, you know. I mean, I'm not sure I could have predicted it 20 years ago. I don't know if I can predict it now. So I think, you know, you have to kind of know what you think is important individually. I have seen a number of people over my scientific careers that have tried to chase trends, you know. So I remember connectionism was a very big trend, you know, in the early 90s, right? So a lot of people started, well, I have to have my connectionist model, you know. The people that have chased the trends in science, you know, generally haven't been the people that have been most successful. I think it's the people that, you know, that follow their instincts, that know kind of this is important, right? Don't do something because it's what everybody's doing right now. Do something because it's, you know, getting you real answers about the problem you care about. And so having said that, you know, I've never been a good person at identifying trends and chasing them. And I don't really know where it's going right now. I think it's expanding hugely. You know, it's getting to be information overload, so it's kind of hard to keep track of everything. And I don't know what the next big advance is going to be. I can tell you things that I think are important right now. I think one of the things that, in terms of human psychology and human neuroscience, that we really have to start focusing on is individual differences.
Yeah.
You know, almost everything we've done up to now, you know, with exceptions, of course, has been how do most people work.
Yeah.
What really makes us interesting is how do people differ. And, of course, that's completely relevant to applying this science to most anything, like psychopathology. Why is this person suffering and this person not? So I do think that's going to be a huge area of research. That brings in a lot of factors like genetics, but I think genetics gets a lot of attention when other factors don't, like differences in experiences and how we conceptualize them and categorize them, differences in social support. You know, so I do think the sort of social aspects of human behavior have a huge influence on how we function, and trying to characterize those in a sophisticated way is quite difficult. And in all this excitement about brain science, sometimes I think we forget about those basic things, and they're going to be very important, not only in sort of understanding social behavior, but understanding genetics and how genetics and environment interact.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because certainly with increasing kinds of technology, the prospect appears of, as you say, a science of individual differences.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, that's almost counter to the view of what science does, which is to look for
we're looking for regularities in individual differences, right? Don't get me wrong.
All right.
Right? We're looking for why is your memory better than this person's memory? Why do you develop PTSD and this person does not?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's not the case, that we're, trying to say why, ultimately we could say, why every person's different, but we have to understand all the factors that go into it in detail to be able to do that, right? So we are looking for patterns that emerge, but patterns that predict differences as opposed to patterns that predict similarities.
So where to locate somebody on a mindscape, as it were.
Yeah. And I think, the sort of questions we were talking about with ethics and, going into the courtroom, I mean, one of the big challenges and when people have talked to me about going into the courtroom is I can't possibly say, what you as an individual actually remember.
Yeah.
I can't look into your mind and know. I can know these are the kinds of things that people would remember. These are the kinds of situations that would produce accurate memories. These are the kind of situations that will produce inaccurate memories, mm-hmm. right? That much I can know. But if I actually now had more information, not just about those regularities, but about you, how is your general memory ability? Mm-hmm. Are you somebody who has a tendency to extrapolate a lot or not? Then I might actually have a better prediction about you on top of those generalities about memory.
There's a question I always ask women scientists about this, mm-hmm. and whether I should retire this question. Is it more difficult to have been a woman going through science? And they always say to me, no, keep asking the question. Yes, it was harder.
Yes, I agree.
But you're now a lab director, right? So
sure.
Essentially, so you.
That doesn't make it any difference. I mean, I spoke to a woman last night who went to the presentation I was at, and she was a Marine, and she was a Marine. She's now, working in private industry. And we talked about women in the Marines and private industry, and she said how there's very few women here speaking at this symposium. And, mm-hmm. I'm so used to being the only woman, I'm like, wow, there's tons of them. But, what do we have, like 15% or something, right? And it's still a huge issue. I think, you don't get away with having this sort of big ego sometimes because, you become a B word, whereas a guy can kind of extrapolate a lot more. There's a more, you have to balance work-life things in a way that a lot of men don't. And I do think, it's been tough at times. I think, again, you have to have a core confidence in yourself. But one of the things I see is there is, I train a lot of women, right? Then you get up higher levels, there are a lot of women. So every time I'm on an advisory board or for some science center, I point this out, how come I'm the only woman in the room?
Yeah.
And I always get the same answer. Well, the good news is half of our graduate students are women and half of our postdocs are women. And I say, funny, because when I was a graduate student, half of the graduate students were women and half of the postdocs were women, and now I'm the only woman in the room.
Yeah.
So obviously, the training part in and of itself is not the problem.
Yeah.
And how we, how we progress there's not a clear answer. I do think I've seen some progress. I do see more women at the table. 15% is a good number for me from where I've been, because sometimes it's just me.
Yeah.
It's certainly not a satisfactory number.
Yeah.
But it's better than, it often has been. And I think people are aware of it more so. So, I do a little bit of research on implicit bias. With my collaborator, Mazrin Banaji at Harvard. And one of the things about implicit bias is that it's implicit. So we're not consciously trying to exclude women often. I think a lot of people have good intentions.
Mm-hmm.
Once we know it exists, the best we can do is enact strategies to protect ourselves from it.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, I myself, when I organize a conference, I might, the first time, I think of the potential speakers, I write down a list and I look at it, I'm like, where are all the women? And the minute you say that to yourself,
mm-hmm.
this flood of, females come in. But even for women, our search engines are not necessarily, our image of science is not necessarily female, right? So So, you know, I do that on a regular basis. I always ask myself that question. Mm-hmm. You know, when I once wrote a letter for a graduate student, and somebody from the university where she was, you know, they were evaluating her said, well, you didn't say she was intelligent. So I went back and I looked at my letter. I did say she was intelligent. They didn't pick up on that, but it wasn't the first thing I said, you know. So now I reread every letter I write. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, even the people that, you know, even women, when we're well-intentioned, we can, these little subtleties that are just part of the society we grew up in seep in. And the more that we're aware of that, the more that we can address that. You know, I've had debates in faculty meetings where they say, well, it's, you know, how do we know what she did was independent of her mentor? I'm like, have we ever hired a graduate student who didn't work with their mentor? Mm-hmm. Why do we bring this up for this woman? Mm-hmm. You know, and you point that out and they're like, of course.
Yeah.
What was I thinking? Right. But it's that subtle. And I think having that realization that it's that subtle allows us now to find ways to combat bias. But most people don't want to even acknowledge it. You know, that it could exist in them.
Was science always going to be the thing? Are you a frustrated something else? Is something else you wanted to be ever? You know, opera singer?
No.
It's always science?
No, it was not always science. It just happened to be science. Oh, but, okay. But no, it's not. I have no desire. You know, I'm a frustrated athlete. I was an athlete. Yeah. You know, I miss being an athlete. But you know, I don't think you can be, you know, an athlete in your 40s anyway. So.
Yeah. If I gave you a time travel token,
yes,
and said you can use this to bring anybody from history, any time,
wow,
to your dinner table, somebody you've always wanted to ask a question of, have a conversation with, anybody spring to mind?
It'd probably be a member of my family. You know, I have probably, you know, maybe my grandfather or grandmother.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not that interesting.
Because they were also scientists, or...?
It wouldn't invite him back for science. It wouldn't be a science discussion, put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, the things I find interesting in life outside of science, you know, outside of my work, I find a lot of other things interesting, you know, so I have a lot of other interests that are not science.
Like what?
You know, like sports, like arts, like, you know, most of my friends are not scientists, and I find that's an important part of the balance of my life. You know, I enjoy talking about science, but I enjoy talking about life. Mm-hmm. You know, and I find when I'm hanging out with scientists, in spite of the fact that they may be fabulous people that could be great friends of mine, we always end up talking about science. You know, mm-hmm. So I have a large number of friends that are not scientists. They tend to be in the media and the arts and, you know, some bankers and some designers. And to me that, you know, informs my life. And I think, you know, at some level it also informs my science. Part of the reason I got into emotion research to start was I was studying, you know, memory research, and we were doing it by showing a list of words to people, which is kind of how, you know, we often do memory research. You know, and when you really think about it, you know, and this was a question at the time my boyfriend's mother asked me, like, you know, so, you know, how does that tell me about my memory? And you know, I could give her an answer, but it's a good question. Like, how often do we memorize lists of words? And at the time, in the study of cognition, emotion was really almost excluded. It was sort of something you controlled for. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's a realistic way to think about how, you know, how the science of ourselves, you know, is applicable to our everyday life, because emotion is prevalent in everything. And so it really was sort of this interest in thinking about my science as it relates to, you know, everybody, you know, the people I hang out with who are not scientists, that got me, I think, into studying emotion.
So do you read a lot of literature? I mean, is that...
I read a lot of literature, like, in the summers and at the beach, you know, that's when I kind of... Because, you know, during the... I'm a voracious reader to the point where I won't go to sleep because I have to finish a book. Mm. So, you know, during the academic year, when I got to wake up and teach a class, I tend to avoid those books. I read The New Yorker. And then the summer, and, you know, when I have a little more time, it doesn't matter if I stay up all night reading a book, then I read, you know...
I was just thinking
literature.
That in terms of emotions, in terms of the study of human nature and so on,
yeah.
There's really nothing there until you get to sort of either Montaigne or Shakespeare, mm-hmm. When there's this real self-examination going on.
Oh, I don't think that's true. I think that happens all the time.
I think this was the view of some of the literary critics anyway, yeah. that Shakespeare evokes such amazing different characters.
Yeah.
And how does one person pull that sort of stuff off?
Yeah.
Makes you think about theory of other minds and putting yourself in other people's shoes and so on.
Well,
and
you know,
when
I think
about emotions, the difficulty of trying to put yourself in somebody else's neurons and sort of walk a mile in their neurons to get some sense of what's really going on with them. That's a tricky issue.
Yeah, it is.
And
but you know, if you think about it, we're all amateur psychologists, right? Just by virtue of being a human being, you're an amateur psychologist. And sometimes scientists, you know, who study things like psychology, you know, can learn from amateur psychologists, you know, in terms of ideas and theories and hypotheses and things that we can actually test in a laboratory. But that's, you know, I teach Introduction to Psychology at NYU. It's my one big class. And part of the reason I offered to teach it was because I realized, you know, I thought it would be good practice for me in terms of, you know, presenting to people. And if I can't make you interested in the science of you, that's pretty pathetic, right? And that's what psychology is. It's the science of you, the science of how you work. And so, you know, so I think in all of literature, we're playing with psychology, you know, and some may argue Shakespeare did it better than most, and, you know, he did. But, you know, you could read almost any novel, and that's really what it's about.
Last question.
Yes.
What are you optimistic about?
What am I optimistic about? You know, I actually, you know, I'm answering this question in part because of where we are today. But I actually do think we are going to get much better at treating mental disorders with the types of science we're doing now. When I speak to journalists about things like reconsolidation, I always try to sort of dampen my enthusiasm a little bit, because for the sole reason that we really aren't there yet. And what I hate to do is give false hope. You know, so, you know, when an article comes out about something that could be useful in treating disorders like PTSD, you know, I get lots and lots of emails from people who are truly, truly suffering that I can't possibly help, and that, and I don't want to give that message that we are there. But I think we're getting there. I think understanding how memory works is going to lead to innovative treatments for things like anxiety disorders and other disorders. So I am quite optimistic about that. I think it's going to be a while. It's going to be, you know, probably hundreds of dissertations from now. But I think it's going to happen. We're going to get much better at it.
Still a good field for a student to go into, then.
I think it is a good field for a student to go into. I just think, you know, you got to love it.
All right, well, Liz Phelps, thanks very much.
All right, bye.